Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. I'm Ed Fallon, your host, and we're broadcasting from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa. Underwriting for this program provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan, local, and global foods and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Our program's bumper music provided by the Des Moines Irish Session. I would like to introduce Kirti Jayakumar. She is joining us from India, and I understand it's pretty hot there right now.
Yes, it's crazy hot in the day, and we're having a thunder shower outside right now.
So. Oh, we're having one of those too. I guess we're united through thunderstorms right now.
Tell me about it. Yeah. But it's interesting because this isn't supposed to be the weather at this point in time. So yeah. Climate change, right?
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. A little bit of your background, though. You've got a master's degree in peace studies and conflict resolution from a university in Costa Rica. I did not know about that.
Yeah, University of Peace.
My son-in-law is from Costa Rica. I was not aware of the University for Peace. So very good. And you've also got a degree in peace and conflict studies from the Center for Trust, Peace, and Security.
That's right, in Coventry University in the UK, yes.
And a lot of your work is focused on helping survivors of gender-based violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is correct. For the past 15 years, it started with legal advice, and now it's moved to support for online violence, which is now seeing an outsized increase with the advent of AI. So, yeah.
Is online violence an issue in India?
Oh, big time. You can be targeted for the political views you have and for your gender identity and just existing online with both of those things. And it's pretty difficult because it's hard to identify a perpetrator on these platforms and pin them down because it's just so porous and not confined to a single border.
Mm. And do you get much pushback for those for the positions you take, for the actions you're involved with?
Oh, yes, big time. So one of the biggest challenges is holding a person accountable when all their lives they've just never been held accountable for violence. Mm. And so when you hold up the mirror to them, they don't like what they see there, but they don't want to confront the ugliness they see. So they will turn over and give you a hard time for pointing it out. Mm. So that's been, a very large part of this journey for 15 years of work here.
And is it mostly violence within a marriage, violence of a man against a woman? Or is it other types
as well? To the latter. Lots of instances, it is violence perpetrated by men or young boys at an adolescent age. And very often it does involve some kind of an intimate partnership. And if not, it is a spurned lover, if you will. So there's somebody that expresses their interest in a woman and she says no, and her expression of her agency is immediately rejected and violence is what she's responded with. So that's a very common phenomenon here.
Do you have support within the political structure for the work you're doing in opposition to that kind of violence?
I want to say yes and no, because it depends really on what kind of political structure you're looking at. So I live in a state that is governed by a political party that's distinct from the central government, as we call it. We're partly unitary and partly federal. So we have a central government and then a state level government. So in my state, which is Tamil Nadu, we have one of the most progressive governments, and our history markers will tell you that women have done beautifully in terms of education and access to employment when compared to the rest of the country. But the apparatus in the center is not as amicable to women's rights. They do tend to believe in instrumentalizing women to their end But in really supporting women, it's never substantial or even a matter of equity for them.
And is that the party of Narendra Modi, the current ruler of India?
That is correct. That is correct. An interesting choice of words there. I recently read a beautiful post which said that we should be thinking of political parties in positions of leadership as serving the people rather than ruling the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you know, that really checks out, because that's the egoistic part of leadership that's at play right now, about ruling India instead of serving its people. So, mm-hmm.
It wasn't an intentional choice, but yeah, I guess it worked out. So Modi has been in power for, he's been in power for 12 years now, and there has been pushback throughout his tenure as the prime minister, correct? More recently, someone in his administration called young people who were protesting a scandal within the educational community. The minister called the young people cockroaches, and we've talked about this on this program before, and people jumped on that and says, okay, we are the cockroach party, and they've been mobilizing at an incredible level and with some success. Is that that's my take on it from afar. What's your take?
I want to say that there is reason to believe that there has been some success, but I also think that if we're addressing the symptoms and not the root cause, that success is only that far. I mean, it doesn't go very far, to put it lightly. So the Chief Justice of India, who basically heads the Supreme Court, called young people, particularly from Generation Z or Gen Z, cockroaches, because he said they were just lazy and sitting on social media and unemployed. And somehow that identity was just beautifully reclaimed by young people. They went out on the streets, they mobilized against the government, they called for the resignation of the education minister, and they succeeded, which is excellent, which is fantastic, because for 14 years, we've seen one way or another the system really being challenged, but without enough of an effort to really change that. I say 14 rather than 12, mainly because even in the 2 years before the Modi government came up, there was enough of a warning that this was where we were headed. So from that perspective, there's a lot of hope, definitely. But calling for a resignation, calling for superficial change is only going to get us this far. And that's where their real work is ongoing, which is actually harder. It's tougher to see, but they're really, really putting their boots on the ground, working very hard to actually question the system at multiple levels. But this is also happening outside of the metropoles. Even as the cockroach Janata Party made the news internationally, we have very strong bodies on the ground protests that are happening against land grabbing for data centers, the displacement of indigenous populations, the constant corruption that's happening with corporate establishments. And those protests are not receiving the light of day because it doesn't use the dominant language of English. And it's still continuing to fight on ground.
And the dominant language of English is that some of us see it as declining in terms of its dominance, but even within India, it's still an important venue of communication in terms of building political power?
I'm going to say yes and no to that. One part of it is in terms of social power rather than political power, because the caste system here in India is entirely a question of hierarchy, and it's aspirational to be seen speaking English, to be seen being socially and upwardly mobile. And that kind of hierarchy is what keeps people in positions of power because of their upper caste status, to, you know, in a place where they can hold on to that power. So education that's accessible is in English. Your travel documents are in English. And that level of caste privilege is one of the ways in which power continues to curl in the hands of a few. The no part of it is there is an active movement that is on the rise, questioning the need to use English as the dominant way of speaking and the dominant way of engaging. But the flip side of that, Ed, is when you are rejecting one language, the dominant other comes up, and that's another form of colonization, which we haven't been able to crack the code with. So now it's becoming a Hindi dominance. I come from the South, where the imposition of Hindi is vehemently opposed. But that's being pushed as the agenda, saying we want to reject what the British left us, but we will support Hindi dominance. But we're a country of so many languages.
What, like 15 official languages, yeah. I believe? Is that right? 15?
Official languages.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wow.
But thousands more, and still more that are just not even codified in any form of writing, but continue to exist in oral histories.
Right. And so I'm interested that those who are opposing Modi's government, again, primarily led by the Cockroach Party, the young people involved with that, a lot of their strategies involve many of the same tactics that Mahatma Gandhi used to overthrow the British. Well, it wasn't just him, of course, but he's kind of the figurehead that we see from the West here, involved with that independent struggle. But it seems like a lot of the same tactics of nonviolence are being employed. And yet you have the Modi administration kind of embracing the cloak of Gandhi's legacy. And that's difficult for some people to sort out, because you have both the opposition embracing those techniques and the government that they're opposing claiming to be, you know, a kind of a political and spiritual descendants of the Mahatma's nonviolent action program.
Well, I see exactly what you mean, but I'm just going to widen the lens a bit further. Of course, the techniques of nonviolence are very much a vital part of the protests here, but they are not the only ones, in the sense that there's a lot of creativity, there's a lot of ludic resistance, there's a lot of playfulness. If you've had a chance to look at social media, there was lots of music, there was dance, there were memes that were making the rounds there. But this is to say that Gen Z is not confined to the wisdom of Gandhi alone, but actually look to another source of wisdom, which personally for me is something I value even more than Gandhi's, which is Ambedkar. Ambedkar was another leader, a very important leader in India's history, but seldom gets talked about because he was asking the uncomfortable questions about the caste system. And Ambedkar talked about how true liberation will arrive if we're willing to decolonize from the grassroots up, not just remove, you know, the symptomatic presentation of colonization. That force, that wisdom has been at the center of the Cockroach Janata Party. Now, with the dominant party claiming to support Gandhian values, I actually find it as, I think, the worst form of hypocrisy, because the man who assassinated Gandhi was from the same political party that backs the BJP, which is the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or the RSS.
I think Nathuram Godse.
Exactly. So it's just, I think it's just a bunch of alphabet soup for the incumbent government to be pressing the right buttons and saying a couple of fun things that make them look good. Because it's interesting that this would be the stance outside of India. That's what people think outside of India, that they believe in Gandhian values. And that's where the dissonance is, because people want to know if it's really true that Modi is authoritarian. So it's part of that image building exercise, I'd say, more than anything else.
Well, one more question before we got to take a break. And this is probably a bigger question than we have time to do it justice with, but climate change is just hitting many parts of the world really, really hard. And India, I mean, you were originally scheduled to be on this program about a month ago, and you were unable to join because of the power outage, because of the extreme heat. What are the kinds of impacts that you're seeing in India because of climate change?
Definitely the extreme temperatures and unseasonal rainfall. Right now, when we're recording, there's a thunderstorm brewing, and it's just very, very unseasonal. But the state I come from, the city I come from, has already seen a sizable rise in the sea levels, and we've had a lot of encroachment of the ocean or the sea into the coastline, with predictions saying that we may be submerged in the next couple of years. We're sitting on an active water shortage possibility. We're also struggling with massive displacement because of the land shortage that climate change is creating. But by and large, the health impact, it's another thing. We're seeing a lot of people falling ill with heat-related diseases, dying by large numbers with heat strokes and starvation and droughts. And we're only being told that this is the beginning. So,
is the government doing anything to address that? I mean, here our president says climate change is a hoax. Is it that bad in India, or is Modi doing something at all to address the problem?
I don't believe he's doing anything at all. When one of the states in the northeast was facing a huge flood crisis just recently, he was up and about taking photographs of himself, showing off some new line of clothing in the handloom belt of India. So it doesn't seem to be an issue of concern for this government. I haven't seen them do anything meaningful or substantive to address climate change. So I would say they probably may not be openly saying it's a hoax, but they're behaving like it is.
You mentioned data centers and how the government has been willing to concede large tracts of land for data center development. And I want to talk about that and related AI issues. But we got to take a short break. Again, with me today, folks, Kirti Jayakumar. She's joining us from, I think I'm saying it correctly, Chennai.
Perfect.
Chennai, yes, India, in southern India. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be continuing that conversation. Again, a reminder that underwriting for this program provided by Dr. David Drake, a psychiatrist serving patients in Iowa and Colorado. More information at 515-229-5085.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. This is Ed Fallon, your host, coming to you from right smack in the middle of the U.S., Des Moines, Iowa. Underwriting for the Fallon Forum provided by real estate agent Joe Henry. More information at 515-208-7312. Hey, we're talking with Kirti Jayakumar today. She's joining us from Chennai, India. We've covered a bunch of issues in the first part of this conversation, but I really want to focus on AI. And let's start with a comment you made during our first segment conversation about data center construction and the government kind of helping corporations that want to turn tracts of land into large data centers. I mean, this is an issue that is playing out exactly the same way here. Government is, to some extent, helping data centers, helping corporations that want to build them. And there's a lot of public pushback, and it's bipartisan across the political spectrum. What does it look like in India?
I would say nothing different. Just recently, we had a whole tract or corridor that was completely cleared out. There are forests that were actually stewarded and held by indigenous communities for generations, but they have been completely cleared out without so much as a conversation with those communities, all for the sake of data centers. This is particularly alarming for two reasons. One, the complete disregard of these communities and their longstanding history. And two, this entire institution of data centers is coming up in an earthquake-prone area. Imagine what the loss of tree cover can do and the kind of devastation and harm that may come from the potential, I don't even want to go there, the potential destruction of trees and tree cover and plant cover. And it's just astounding to me that we want,
And are the data centers being built or proposed to be built all across the country, or is there one particular area where it's a problem?
Well, from the moment, it seems like there are specific regions that are being cleared out, forest cover mainly. But it's not really clear how many more are being planned and where they're being planned for the future. But all of the regions where we're seeing data centers come up are places that were once rich with greenery.
And which corporations are behind them?
That's a tricky one. So this isn't a very clearly public information, but there's reason to believe that there's the Adani and Ambanis, you know, the billionaires in India that have a hand in the data centers, and even just sort of the telecom industry, if you will. But we're also seeing other foreign corporations like Meta and Google also having a presence here. So it's not particularly clear exactly where we might find those data centers owing their allegiance, if that makes sense, or who's going to use those data centers. But this is where we are at the moment.
Yeah. And we're, I think, in the same place. In the U.S., they're building them all over the place, primarily in rural areas. In Des Moines, we've seen them. I mean, Des Moines is a city of a little over 200,000 people. The Des Moines metro is maybe 700,000. And we've seen outside the largest, most developed areas, quite a few of these data centers going in. And it kind of, I think it kind of took people by surprise when people started realizing, okay, what is this all about? And we started looking at the water consumption and the energy consumption. People started really coming out in force to oppose them. And so I think what we're seeing here now is it's becoming more and more difficult for politicians to approve data centers, and data center construction is becoming an issue in the upcoming election. And is it that way as well in India?
Oh, big time, big time. There's lots and lots of protests on ground against the mega data center projects. And for the same reasons as well, scarcity in water supply, electricity demands, noise pollution, and of course the displacement that it's causing in residential areas. What we're seeing here at the moment is, I think there's been, over the past month, I would say, an active counter to a $15 billion data center that Google wants to set up here in India. And then we're also seeing these protests happen in the south again, in particularly a state called Andhra Pradesh, where there's lots of talks about data centers coming up with the Adani infrastructure, as well as the Raiden Infotech, which is part of Google. And most of these protests are not being talked about enough in the media. There's not enough attention to what they're bringing to the table. And they've actually been calling out these companies by saying, we cannot drink data.
I like that.
So if you're replacing our water, how are we going to survive?
So is the Modi administration in support of data center construction?
Well, I think they are deeply techno-optimist. So that means their desire is to continue to make India, I want to say, well-equipped when it comes to technology, not necessarily equitably supported in that journey. So the techno-optimistic side of this country, while it can do so much for its people, is not taking its people along. You can be techno-optimistic by seeking to enhance access for your people, but if you're creating technology at the cost of your people, it's just not going to serve anyone, is it?
Right. And there, my sense is that the opposition to data centers and the explosive growth in AI is kind of, there's kind of two primary camps. One is saying, okay, AI is really good for some things. Let's regulate it. Let's make sure that it doesn't grow too fast and in the wrong directions. There's another camp, and I kind of see people like Jeff Hinson and others who have been very instrumental in the establishment of AI is saying, no, this is just bad. And to me, I don't know whether you've seen the movie The Matrix.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course, yeah.
To me, that's where we're going if we keep on this track. I mean, especially as AI becomes more and more kind of self-motivating, and inclined to just want to do its own thing. I mean, how do you, at some point you can't control that. That's where I'm coming from. I get kind of impatient we can regulate this. And you may be at that same perspective. I really don't know. So I'm just, you know, throwing it out to you. What do you think of, what's your take on what we should do about AI? Regulate or abolish? Not that we can put the genie back in the bottle completely, but what should we do?
Well, I think I am exactly where you are, Ed. There's a part of me that wishes that we could put the genie back in the bottle, because we should have been asking the key question of should this technology exist at all before it came into being. But now it is here, and it's being sold to us as this absolutely inevitable reality that we cannot avoid. I want to say that it's unavoidable, but not inevitable, which means that we still have a chance to do right through some form of governance. And that governance is not going to arrive through law and policy. It's impossible for a one-size-fits-all law to determine such contextual realities of what AI can do. Now, if you take the EU AI Act, which tells you high risk, medium risk, and low risk AI should be treated according to the level of risk, you might think AI that's going to obviously cause, say, detrimental harm to a society with war should be banned. But what about a tool like ChatGPT that's encouraging a young person to die by suicide? I think that's high risk. The EU AI Act will not see that. And so the challenge we're up against right now with governance is that we are not doing well enough. We assumed that law and policy got us far enough to regulate anything. We haven't been regulating ourselves well with law and policy. What's it going to do to a piece of technology that we cannot understand enough about? You know, there's this really powerful line from the Harry Potter series where Molly Weasley says to her daughter, Ginny Weasley, that you shouldn't be trusting something that you cannot determine is particularly clear about where it puts its mind. She's talking about the diary that Ginny Weasley writes into that's feeding back to her. It has a mind, but you don't know how it's thinking. I think that line applies so well to AI. It has something comparable to the mind. It's obviously not human intelligence, but we don't know how it's working. Why is it making a choice to use a particular word after? What's creating that probabilistic output? We don't know. That's the black box.
Yeah.
And that's what's likely to run the world someday, and that's terrifying.
Yeah, and run the world someday, and with human need kind of very secondary to what the machines themselves determine they need. I mean, it's almost hard to really grasp that this could be possible, but... I point to the movie The Matrix, but well before that, maybe you're familiar with 2001: Space Odyssey.
Of course.
HAL. Okay.
Of course.
Someone please explain to me why that is not where this is heading.
I have every reason to agree with you, Ed. I think that it is heading that way. Just a couple of days back, I read and heard a TED Talk. I read this online and then heard a TED Talk where a young woman from India has found a way to actually write data into DNA.
So run that by me that again. Write data into DNA.
Into DNA.
How does that
work? So that means...
Okay.
Well, I don't know the science of it, and I couldn't explain it well enough if I tried.
And even if you did, I couldn't understand it. It's a TED Talk, okay.
So it's by an Indian woman. She's 24, and she's come out with this technology that she's been able to actually prove works, where she's able to write data into DNA. She talks about how people have been able to write fear into DNA, and the next step is to... I don't know what turn you and me into data centers.
Could you write concert?
That is scary, Ed.
Could you write concert pianist into DNA?
I would love that. I know that I could maybe jam across the ocean.
Could you? Is that what she's talking about? I mean, or is it?
Well, something like that. Well, what I did see was how there could be 1,000 movies in 4K that could be coded into your DNA. That's the volume of information that could go in. And then, of course, after that, my brain shut down because it was just beyond anything I could comprehend.
Yeah, same.
But it's astounding. And when we're thinking of this as real, goodness knows what the future is going to look like. And that is terrifying.
So to
it
me,
makes me want to go back to when I was in fourth grade and watching cartoons and thinking that should be our future.
Well, we're a few years apart in age, but I had the same experience in fourth grade. Different cartoons, probably. But it's hard to wrap one's mind around it, because where the mind thinks you probably need to go with this is not any place we really want to go. It's not comfortable. And I guess we start with, to me, even though I guess I see these two different camps in terms of, you know, what level of opposition do we have to AI, I guess the camp that says let's regulate it is probably the only realistic thing we can do at this point, is to come up with the strongest regulatory framework and hope that that puts the brakes on the worst possible scenarios.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And it's the saddest part, because if this is the best we're able to do, we're still leaps behind. The technology is developing like that, and governance is at snail's pace. Mm-hmm. So it's still not good enough, but it's the best we can do, which is disheartening.
And here in the U.S., we've had states that have tried to come up with regulations relevant to AI, and the Trump administration has squashed those, and now it's supposed to be a federal effort. But is even any federal effort, whether it's U.S. or India or somewhere else, EU, doesn't this have to be a global effort?
It has to, primarily because the technology is crazy global. Something that's developed in your part of the world is now running lives in my part of the world. Mm. And that's dangerous. It's dangerous. I mean, it can be excellent if you really think about it. There's ways for how we can use these technologies to level the playing field. I could access education in the US without having to leave. So the challenges of a visa travel would be completely mitigated. But that's not what it's being used for, is it? Mm. We're seeing deep fakes, we're seeing violence, we're seeing mental health manipulations. And that needs to be regulated big time as a global concerted effort.
And we're seeing lots of jobs being lost as well. I assume that's the case in India as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's catastrophic, because there's no amount of enough labor available or enough jobs available for a country that is so populous. Hmm. And against that backdrop, when you're already losing jobs to AI, it's only dismal, because we have a very large youth population that is struggling with unemployment.
Hmm.
And so much of it is because of AI. There's also this other stream that's saying AI is going to create jobs, but those jobs are dangerous. Content labeling. I know young women in India are being forced to watch disturbing content in the name of data labeling and cleaning just to be able to train an AI tool. Those are not the kind of jobs we should be giving young people.
Yeah.
Or anyone, for that matter.
Yeah. No, there was an excellent book called Empire of AI. Is it Karen Ho? About some of the abuse of employees in Kenya and Colombia and other places as well. Mm. So, I mean, it's, and I know that there are cool things we can do with AI, you know. If my wife and I run an urban farm, if I want to search, okay, what is causing this particular problem on this particular plant? You know, I mean, I don't use AI, but, when I do a search for that information, I think AI actually is helping to pull up the answer. And I got to admit, it's usually right on. It's usually right on. So that's helpful, but not essential. I can go the slower route and go through a more traditional search. 30 years ago, I could go to the library and look this up. Again, it takes longer.
Exactly.
But to me, I think of AI and nuclear weapons in the same way. Well, I think we've gone beyond saying that there's any good use for a nuclear weapon. But back, this is before your time, back when nuclear weapons were first becoming common or in big production, there was talk about using them for, quote, peaceful purposes, like blowing up mountains in order to build a road, you know? That was considered a good purpose. I wish, like nuclear weapons, I wish AI had never been invented. It's here. We have to regulate it. And hopefully regulated in a significant way, and hopefully do it cooperatively with other nations around the world. You know, we can't, not, one country just can't do this on its own. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, 100%. Right now in our upcoming election in November, data centers and AI are a pretty prominent conversation. I don't know when your next election is in India.
2029.
Gosh, you got...
Yeah, for five-year terms.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so is even for some of the parliamentary offices as well, it's not just for president, not just...
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, no. It's all 2029, but state-level elections will happen at different times.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And do you see data centers, AI coming up for, you know, coming forth as issues in those campaigns?
I think there will be issues for sure, without doubt. But I think the more everyday challenges of employment, of safety on the streets, of the freedoms of mobility and expression, they will be significant to address. I'm not saying that India is automatically accepting of AI data centers, but I think that's one of the battles for survival and not the only one. So that's going to become a big issue as well, just the whole question of survival and what that looks like for different populations in different parts of the country.
Well, we could talk a lot more about this, Kirti. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to visit with us, and good luck with your work in India, which, I mean, sounds pretty broad. I know you do a lot of work for those who are affected by gender-based violence, and you're right. You've written a play as well, I believe.
Yes, I've written a play.
Very cool.
That was just out of nowhere. It just happened out of nowhere.
Very cool. Anyway, and I appreciate your work on the AI issue as well. Hey, again, talking today with Kirti Jayakumar, underwriting for this program, provided by Western Optometry. More information at 515-789-3055. Back in a minute. Thanks to our nonprofit partners, including Circle of Peacemakers, formerly the Catholic Peace Ministry. Circle of Peacemakers works with people of all faiths toward a world without war. CPM opposes runaway military spending while domestic needs go unmet. Instead of endless wars, CPM supports diplomacy. Visit circleofpeacemakers.com. At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon, your host here, folks, broadcasting from Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, we got content, of course, that's relevant no matter where you live in the U.S. Underwriting provided by Architecture by Synthesis. More information at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, I want to talk more about the election. My guest, the first half of the program, Kirti, we discussed elections a bit, but I want to talk a little bit more about this fall's election because... It cannot be stated strongly enough that we have to be paying very close attention to efforts to try to undermine the integrity of the election. I mean, President Trump has already, I mean, he's been working on this for years now. It started with, of course, denouncing Biden's victory in the January 6th insurrection. It's continued. It took a leap forward in July when President Trump had a primetime television address in which he claimed that, again, that the U.S. elections were vulnerable to foreign manipulation. And, of course, he repeated, you know, the lie that the 2020 election was stolen. But vulnerable to foreign manipulation. Well, there's no doubt that elections are vulnerable to foreign impact. Fake accounts that, I mean, what have we talked about this a while back on this program where China has, what, 2 million people employed in putting out disinformation about various issues to kind of taint upcoming elections. And so, yeah, this is no new, this is not surprising. And it isn't just Russia and China that does it. We do it too. I mean, countries all over the world use technology to manipulate public opinion in countries whose elections they want to influence. So, yeah, vulnerable to foreign manipulation, not news. But I guess what Trump is trying to suggest by his July address, what he tried to suggest was that there was going to be a very insidious and a kind of a broad attempt to actually corrupt the results. And this is consistent with, I mean, I remember after the primary election in California, he suggested that election had some corruption involved. The whole thing is geared toward getting us to no longer believe that we have fair elections. And I certainly know from experience that elections can be tainted. Again, I've given the example before. When I first won my first election to the Iowa House in 1992, there was another, state house race in the Des Moines Metro where a candidate barely won. And that candidate won in part by having people who did not even live in Iowa. I think one of them lived in California and was registered to vote at, I believe, a bowling alley. Another one might have been registered, I believe, at a pizza parlor. Anyway, those kinds of deceits are objectionable. They're wrong. But you can sometimes get away with them in a close election. It's hard to know how far the president is going to go on this. But here's Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon, who was one of his main political allies in the right-wing talkosphere, let's call it that. He predicted back in July that Trump would declare a state of emergency on national security grounds to, quote, protect elections. Bannon said, take your number two pencil out. It's coming. Just block the last week of August out. It's coming. So I don't know why Bannon, I think the fact that Bannon chose to use pencil instead of pen means he's not entirely sure. He might want to erase it maybe he wants to change the date, but I think we can expect this. I think we can expect President Trump to declare a state of national emergency, national security at risk, foreign influence, maybe not even just foreign influence, but corruption by blue state election officials. And I'm so sick and tired of the blue state, the red state, and both parties, both sides of the, people across the political spectrum do this, but we don't have a blue America or a red America or a blue state. I mean, heck, people have all kinds of opinions and live together and get along. When we stop pretending that we're enemies of somebody who voted differently than us, we realize how much we have in common. And we just need to focus on that. And actually, we talked about data centers earlier. Data centers are a great example of where people agree that there's a problem, regardless of where their political perspective or party registration is, regardless of whether they live in an urban or rural area. The vast majority of Americans and people around the world, I believe, see these data centers as problems. But I digress a bit. My point is that we all have an awful lot to lose by letting the president get away with this. And again, maybe he won't. But Bannon thinks he will. Bannon's pretty well connected. Bannon thinks it's going to be next week. Or maybe this week. This is the last full week of August. We'll see what happens. I think something is going to happen. And for more evidence about that, Wayne Allen Root, he's another right-wing broadcaster. Again, I listen to these folks, so you don't have to. He asked Trump if there would be declaration of a national security emergency regarding elections. And Trump's response, Trump didn't say no. He said, let me just say stranger things have happened, okay? Well, I'll leave it at that. I mean, if that isn't a not so covert way of saying, yeah, we're thinking about this. We're getting ready for it. So what happens when there is a declaration of a national security emergency for the election? What happens? I mean, what is that going to look like? Is the federal government going to insist on taking over the election itself? I mean, elections are left to states. Different states manage them differently. How does this end? We have races where it's pretty clear that Republican incumbents are going to lose their seats. We have open seats where, you know, traditionally that district may be a toss-up, and yet it's going very heavily in favor of the Democratic challenger. So, you know, I mean, to what extent is he going to corrupt the election? Is it, if it's a close election, that's obviously easier to corrupt? I'm broadcasting this program on FCC-regulated stations across the country, and I'll say this, as I always do, I am not a fan of either political party. I am a fan of checks and balances, and that's why we have a judicial system, an administration, and a U.S. Congress. And right now, we don't have, there's really not many, there's no kind of check and balance in place right now. We have had some Republican lawmakers in the Senate, the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House, who have been willing to express independent thoughts. Some of them have been challenged in primary elections with the president supporting an opponent, and those opponents often, in most cases, prevailing. So I understand that it is difficult. If you are a Republican and you've got an independent thought, you're in a difficult place right now. But do not despair. Continue along those lines. Things will change. Again, we've already seen a lot of really key people bail out on the Trump administration. Some of them are, quote, going to spend more time with their families. That's a standard line, right? Who knows what's, I mean, Tulsi Gabbard, for example. I mean, she has to be really, really, really upset about what Trump is doing in Iran. That contradicts everything she's ever said or stood for. Not that she didn't have to give up quite a bit of her integrity in order to take the job in the first place, but, you know, people are bailing out on the administration. And we'll see what happens with that. So if you are a Republican and you have a conscience and a backbone and an independent thought, hang on to those. Don't lose those. And if you're a Democrat, again, we're seeing that Democrats who don't cozy up to the establishment that has run the party for a long time, who don't believe the status quo is working really well, those Democrats are starting to have some success in electoral politics. They may have success in fall, in the November election. And again, if you have enough, you know, if you have an opposition party, if you have a Republican administration, who knows whether the Senate will be Republican or Democrat. The House is likely to become Democratic. If it's a Democratic House that has enough guts, it can stand up to the Trump administration. It's probably easier for a House controlled by Democrats to stand up to Trump than it is for a House controlled by Republicans with a handful of Republicans that are like Thomas Massey or others that have come under Trump's fire. The best thing to do right now, find a candidate you like and work really hard for them. Because if their margin of victory is significant, it's going to be much harder for the Trump administration to declare that election invalid. Although, again, if they do go ahead with the threat of declaring a national security emergency, who knows to what extent anything that happens at the polls is going to be accepted. It's hard to know. All we can do, we don't know how this is going to play out, so all we can do now is fight as hard as possible for the people we believe in. I'll leave it at that, folks. Thank you for tuning in. We got one more segment for you. Kathy and I, with our farm and food conversation, we're going to pick up a conversation we had recently about efforts by some staff within the city of Des Moines to make it harder to grow food and the pushback that's occurring on that and an update on how effectively that pushback is going forward. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Underwriting for this program provided by Dr. Kim Holding with Story County Veterinary Clinic, serving Story County pets for over 30 years. More information at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design-build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
All right, hey folks, good to have you back with us here on the Fallon Forum. Underwriting for this program provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan local and global foods and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Kathy Burns joining me. Hey, Kathy, how are you?
Good, and we continue to support local food as Birds and Bees Urban Farm.
Which has come under fire in our fair city, sadly.
We talked about this, was it last week?
Yes.
And a woman named Allison Stewart, a Des Moines resident, she went to bat against the city to save a garden space on her property. It wasn't a big space, but she had planted it for tenants in a house that they own, and they are growing food there.
That was nice of her.
And the space happens to be between the sidewalk and the street, which is a public right-of-way that the city refers to as the border area.
Yeah, it's a very interesting designation because, you know, that strip of grass between the sidewalk and the street is owned by the city, but you're responsible to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
And you're responsible for maintaining the sidewalk.
Yes.
And if the sidewalk is broken and cracked, you're responsible to pay for it.
Well,
it's kind of a... It's a very weird setup.
I think they consider it part of your responsibility of living in a city to help, to be a resident.
But you don't have to repair the road in front of your house.
Thank goodness. Well, earlier this year, she was cited for what they referred to as a nuisance, what the code refers to as a nuisance. Several nuisances. One of them was growing food in the public right-of-way. And another one, she did have a couple of steel posts that were bolstering some soil that was trying to go out into the street after a tree had fallen, and they removed. So she was agreeable to removing the steel posts right away. But it was the growing of food that was the key discussion in the hearing that she had. When they cited her, she requested a hearing, and that happened just last week.
Didn't they call some of the garden debris?
Yes. Well, she was asking for three things. In her key arguments, she opened with asking for the violation order to be dismissed because she was cited for, quote, debris, but her space, as she says, is well-maintained garden. In her definition, and a lot of people's definition, is not debris. The second thing she asked for is the violation would not be dismissed, that the case be suspended until the Food Sustainability Advisory Committee reviews the code itself. And third, she was saying if the order cannot be dismissed or delayed, she wants to at least delay action until the end of the growing season. She said November or December. And that's because their neighbors rely on the food that's growing there.
And so did there was a hearing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved her closing statement, or part of her closing statement. I'm gonna read that. Some of the issue is about gentrification. It's about those who have money trying to enforce upon those who do not arbitrary standards that are without reason or research. A uniform look only benefits a few, but takes a great toll on many of us. Good gardening is a beautiful, joyful, community-building experience, and one that I love to share with my neighbors. It brings people of all walks of life together in gratitude and friendliness, which makes Des Moines the kind of city I like to live in.
That's really nice. That could be put to music.
She did a wonderful job arguing her case and presenting evidence. The city, of course, had evidence to present And
see, we're talking specifically the city engineer.
There was a city inspections representative gave some testimony about the series of how the citation, the series right. of events, how the citation was developed and given to her, and her responses.
And the city engineer called it a safety hazard.
He also emailed me after I spoke at a city council hearing on behalf of Ms. Stewart and people who want to grow. And that's a big conversation, too. The city has always allowed food to be grown in the right-of-way, specifically by its never having been mentioned in city code that you could not. However, according to some of the city officials, the city has never allowed food to be grown in the right-of-way because they didn't specifically write it into the code. So there's a discrepancy there. The city engineer also cited safety hazards such as rotten or decaying fruits and vegetables. People could slip and fall on it. Concerns with the food itself, indicating that food that's grown along the street receives spray from tires and dust and sand and dirt.
Spray, we mean water.
Kind of referring to those as toxic. And
water.
Water and sand and dirt are not maintenance issues. They can create some messes that city has to clean up. But the one I did chuckle at was health and pest issues. Fruits and vegetables can attract animals that can cause damage or pose a health risk. There can also be health risk issues for pets who may eat discarded fruits and vegetables within the right of way.
So a little rover comes along, takes a bite of an apple, mm-hmm. dies a horrible death. I mean, what am I missing here?
My first response is, if you don't want Rover to eat a piece of fruit on the ground, keep your leash on that dog and make sure they don't when you're walking them. But I did look up a number of fruits can contain some substances that can cause some digestive issues for animals. Some can lead to toxicity and hospital stays. But a dog would have to eat very large number of, say, apple seeds to get sick. They would also have to have not just swallowed them whole, but chewed through them enough to release the cyanide, which is the toxic chemical in that. So we continue to monitor this.
We will continue to update you on this because it's an interesting situation and probably relevant to cities and towns all over the U.S.
I should say she was still cited with the violation, but she has been given till the early November to remove the quote nuisances.
Kathy, thanks for joining me, and thanks to my guest today, Kirti Jayakumar, and to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Detterman, Charles Goldman, and Kathy. Thanks also to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music, underwriting provided by Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, architecture by Synthesis and real estate agent Joe Henry. Also, Circle of Peacemakers, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. This is Ed Fallon, your host for the Fallon Forum. Back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.